We're in the second section, if you will. And actually, this section runs all the way to the end of the chapter, but that's way more volume than what we can handle today. So we're going to just do to verse 19. And this is the Lord discussing through Isaiah how he's going to judge the Assyrians. This is a very difficult doctrine for most people to assimilate. God will use vicious, ugly, despotic, sinful people to carry out his will. And then he judges them because of what they are and who they are. And that's hard to understand, but here's the text that's going to demonstrate that. Because this is where he's talking about correcting them, and we'll see their ultimate correction in a summary form at the end of today's message, and it'll be realized in much greater detail in the later part of the book of Isaiah. The Assyrians were an extremely warlike people that were completely vicious. Far more vicious than we could ever imagine what they did. They didn't just conquer people. They engaged in severe torture. And I don't even want to go into them today because they're so disgusting what they did. But let's read from Isaiah chapter 10, verse 5, where we picked up from our last session through 19. And then we'll go over these individually, as is our custom. Ho, Assyrian, the rod of mine anger, the staff in whose hand is mine indignation. I will send him against a profane nation, and against the people of my wrath will I give him a charge to take the spoil, to take the prey, and to tread them down like the mire of the streets. Howbeit he meaneth not so, neither doth his heart think so. But it is in his heart to destroy and to cut off nations, not a few. For he saith, are not my princes, all of them, kings? Is not Kel, no, as Carchemish? Is not Hamath as Arpad? Is not Samaria as Damascus? As my hand hath found the kingdom of idols, whose graven images did excel them of Jerusalem and of Samaria, shall I not, as I have done unto Samaria and her idols, so do to Jerusalem and her idols? Wherefore, it shall come to pass that when the Lord hath performed his whole work upon Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, I will punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria in the glory of his high looks. For he has said, by the strength of my hand I have done it, and by my wisdom, for I have understanding, and I have removed the bounds of the peoples, and have robbed their treasuries. And like a valiant man, I have brought down them that sit on thrones. And my hand hath found as a nest the riches of the peoples, and as one gathereth eggs that are forsaken, have I gathered all the earth. And there was none that moved the wing, or that opened the mouth, or chirped. Shall the axe boast itself against him that heweth therewith? Shall the saw magnify itself against him that wieldeth it? As if a rod should wield them that lift it up, or as if a staff should lift up him that is not wood. Therefore will the Lord Jehovah of hosts send among his fat ones leanness, and under his glory there shall be kindled a burning like the burning of fire, and the light of Israel will be for a fire, and his Holy One for a flame, and will burn and devour his thorns and his briars in one day. And he will consume the glory of his forest and of his fruitful field, both soul and body. And it shall be as when a standard bearer fainteth, and the remnant of the trees of his forest shall be few, so that a child may write them. So let's look at the first few verses here, and I've titled this Assyria, which is God's instrument to use to chasten Israel. Now, keep that in mind. It's God's instrument or his tool, if you will, his smith, if you will, to correct Israel, to punish them. So verses 5 and 6 read, "Ho, Assyrian, the rod of mine anger, the staff in whose hand is mine indignation, I will send him against a profane nation. Against the people of my wrath will I give him a charge to take the spoil and to take the prey and to tread them down like the mire of the streets." So this verse starts out with a word called ho. And it gets translated in the American Standard of 1901 just exactly the way it's pronounced in Hebrew. Others say lo or woe or something like that. But actually, the Hebrew word is very, very interesting because it just expresses dissatisfaction along with pain. So that's what the Lord is sensing here. It's painful for him to have to do this, but he's so dissatisfied with Israel that he's going to do it. The destruction of the northern kingdom of Israel was foretold in the previous section that we looked at in our last message here. And it was Isaiah 9, 8 through 10, 4, where we went over those individual components of that poem. It was accomplished by one Shalmaneser, the king of Assyria, in the sixth year of the reign of Hezekiah, King Hezekiah in the south. That was 709 BC. And then a subsequent ruler of the Assyrians, first of all, Assyria and its ruler were really puffed up with pride. They were extremely prideful, and they thought they were conducting the siege that they were doing. There was their own plan. They did not recognize the sovereignty of God. They believed themselves to be sovereign. Now we can look at this and say, well, of course, you know, he wouldn't know God. He wasn't an Israelite. The whole first three chapters of the book of Romans says everybody's without excuse. You have to know there is a genuine God. Part of it, it just comes from the general revelation, looking around you, you know, who made this? How'd you get here? Who are you? Who made your body? Who designed this magnificent machine? Heals itself in most instances and duplicates itself. You know, the rational person understands, as prideful as most people are, understand there's something much bigger than us. And the whole first three chapters of Romans, ending with the summary verse in 23, "For all have fell short of the glory of God." And Paul's saying there, he says, everybody has no excuse to realize there's a God. And he goes over different classes of individuals. Instead of recognizing the sovereignty of God, though, the exceedingly prideful Assyrians believed they were sovereign. Hezekiah was probably in many view the greatest king. And I know we know David is probably the greatest king, but Hezekiah, and I'm going to read something here in a few moments from 2 Kings about this man. But 2 Kings 18 verses 10 to 12 say that at the end of 3 years, they took it. In the sixth year of Hezekiah, which was the ninth year of Hoshea, king of Israel, the king in the north, Samaria was taken. That was the capital city of the north. And the king of Assyria carried Israel away unto Assyria and put them in Halna and Habor, and the river goes on, and the city of the Medes. The Medes and the Persians were conquered, and the Assyrians had control over those areas, but they were originally conquered by the Greeks. Not the voice of Jehovah their God, but transgressed his covenant, even all that Moses, the servant of Jehovah, commanded, and would not hear it nor do it. So what he's saying is that the Jews wouldn't even listen to the Mosaic covenant, wouldn't listen to the law, and as a result, they weren't going to do it. They had just paganized themselves to the point where they were gross idolaters, and they had departed from God so far that his last resort was to bring the Assyrians in. I put a chart in your notes that I want to look at just for a moment there, remembering the dating of today that we use to establish these events in antiquity and even semi-ancient history. The birth of Jesus is recognized as about 2,019 years ago. And the numbers from his birth increase and get higher. In BC, before Christ, we count backwards. So the higher numbers indicate something farther back. So you've got Hezekiah here, assuming his throne in 715 BC, and Hoshea was the last king in the Northern Empire, and he perished in 709 when the Assyrians came in. So you look at the 6 years starting from 715, where Hezekiah starts, and you get down to 709. So that's how this is calculated out. You know, it's really difficult in all of human history for human beings to identify whether it's God that is doing something, whether it's the general decay that came in at the fall, whether it's bad weather, or what. And people will frequently try and do this, and they'll try and second-guess God. Say, well, God must have done that because you didn't this or whatever. And I've heard all kinds of heinous things be leveled on people. And it's inappropriate to do that because you don't know what God's plan is unless it's laid out in Scripture. And that's one of the unique things about the Hebrew prophets. They had a pipeline to God. And what they are saying prophetically comes directly from him. Everything that they've ever given him that has come to pass so far has been done exactly as it was prophesied. 100%. There's no equivocation. There's no, guessing. There's no keeping score. I'd say, well, let's see. God's like, we've got 70% of the prophecies have been fulfilled. 100%. 100%. This is not the horoscope or something. This is 100%. And these Hebrew prophets have this divine perspective, so we can be assured that what they say is going to come to pass if they are events that have yet to come to pass. Here, though, he's saying these things are going to come to pass, and we have more recent history than when this was written to show that they did come to pass. God used divine judgment first against the northern kingdom of Israel, and it was total, it was final. I remember in our last session we looked at the head and the tail, when we're looking at higher levels of society, lower economic strata, everybody, it hit everybody. These events here were totally within the hand of God, and it gives us evidence that he has got complete control over kings, and in this instance, the conquerors. Look what Proverbs 21:1 says, the king's heart is in the hand of the Lord, as the rivers of water, he turneth it whithersoever he will. He controls them. These are difficult concepts for a human being to reconcile, just like it's difficult to recognize God's sovereignty and man's will in different situations. It's impossible. I've listened to so many from seminary on tell me this is God's will. First of all, mankind does not have a free will. We have a will. It's not free. It's limited. I mean, you can't fly if you desire to and jump off a building and so on. You can't defy the laws of physics and many, many other things. But we have a will, and God allows that will to continue. He doesn't control every one of our movements. And it's not clear how he does, but he does. The sovereignty of God is a known biblical doctrine. And man having a will is also a doctrine. That's where, I mean, there's been so many theological disputes over this, you can't imagine. And it usually boils down to a Calvinistic approach to things or an Arminian approach. Calvin was a medieval age, if you will, French theologian, and he became a reformer, and he believed in total predestination, where mankind virtually has no say in his actions. The hyper-Calvinists look at it that way. Our Jacob Arminius came around the same time, a little bit later, and he was in the Netherlands, and he viewed man's sovereignty as being dominant. So man's choice in things was superior and overrode God's sovereignty. So you got two opposite ends of the pole here, and you got equally strong adherents on both sides that argue almost to the death. I mean, some of these things have caused massive problems in the Church of Scotland back in the 1500s and 1600s. Just can't imagine some of the wars that came about. It was viewed as, in many instances, the Catholics and the Reformers, but they've also viewed as the Arminians and the folks from that were following Calvin. Try and keep that. It's not a dilemma. It's more of a item in logic and reason we call an antinomy. In an antinomy, you got two things that are true that don't make sense, and it seem to contradict each other. But it's not a contradiction, because a contradiction means one's true and the other's not. Because this is an antinomy. God is sovereign, and he chooses, and he controls. Mankind has a will and does things. And that is really the essence of what we're looking at here, is that these people sinned. God controls the Assyrians to bring them in, but they're doing what they want, because this is what they normally like to do. And God's just leading them. It's as if he's giving them a whistle or a signal and telling them where to go. And they get the idea, thinking they thought, and they therefore carry out that will. God sends the Assyrians into Israel, the northern kingdom, because of their hypocrisy and their arrogance and their idolatry, because they turned so far away from God. In our translation that I'm using here, it just summarizes profane. The Lord leads these Assyrians to take spoil and prey and to tread them down like the mire or the dirt or the nothingness, if you will, in the streets. It's also important to realize the Assyrians went farther than God wanted. That's one of the reasons why he's going to judge them in this chapter here. They went a lot farther. So did the Babylonians. He used the Babylonians to chastise the southern kingdom later on, culminating in 586 BC. And what they did was go farther than the Lord wanted. We see this in Zechariah 1:15, where God says he's sorely displeased with them against these nations that are at ease. And what he's saying is, I sent these guys to correct the Jews, and they went a whole lot farther and did things a whole lot worse than I wanted. And, you know, the normal thing for us to think of, well, why didn't he stop them? God lets sin go. Look at the sin that surrounds us in this world. He hasn't stopped it, but his plan is moving forward, and it will be eliminated through the Great Tribulation, which is one of the reasons why the tribulation's coming, to make an end to sin and sinful people. So he's saying here, they helped for evil. In the first chapter of Zechariah, and even in the evil, in Jeremiah 21:10, it says, "Behold, I set my face against you for evil and to destroy all Judah." They were the instruments of God, and they cooperated in executing his will and his justice, but they did it with exceeding cruelty and perverse intention. The cruelty that they gave to their opponents, if you will, was just phenomenal. They would take apart the bodies as if one was just filleting a fish while they were still alive and put them up on stakes for everybody to see. And that's what they love. They love to do that. And this is one of the reasons that God is correcting them. They did it out of their own personal pride and zeal. So God is saying in our chapter here, "Ho to Asher, the rod of mine anger, and the staff of his hand of mine indignation. Howbeit he thinketh not so, but his heart is to destroy and cut off nations, not a few." So he's criticizing them for, one, going way beyond what he wanted them to do, and two, the fact that they're generally just sinful, so he's going to correct them for being sinful. This is God's attitude towards the oppressors. He allows the sin to run its course, but he does not let its effects go unnoticed. And that's what's so hard for the human being to reconcile. It goes back to God's sovereignty and man's will. Why does he let sin continue? Why? It's going to be corrected in the Great Tribulation. That is one of the reasons for the Great Tribulation, to make an end of sin and sinful people. So there's two reasons for punishing the Assyrians. This going farther, way, way beyond with cruelty instead of just conquering them. And two, the fact that they're sinful and God used them, then he's going to correct them for that as well. You know, the correction of the southern kingdom of Judah by one Sennacherib, who was a successor of Shalmaneser of Assyria, is also foretold in this chapter. A little later on in our next session, we'll look at that. It was predicted and it was fulfilled in the 14th year of King Hezekiah. So that would be 1701. When he encouraged by the successes, that is, Sennacherib, by his predecessor, was so successful against the 10 tribes in the north, he's thinking, man, I'm going to come up against all the fenced cities of Judah, and took them, and he laid siege to Jerusalem. So essentially, what he did was, he saw what his successor had done, and he said, hey, this is pretty cool. Easy pickings, you know. I'm going to go down in the south and I'm going to get them too. Well, he got 10 cities and he came up against Jerusalem and he couldn't get it. King Hezekiah was the king then. And in a subsequent chapter, we're going to look at this in great detail. It's a fascinating story. But let's move on here and see what the Assyrians' self-deception was in their pride. Isaiah 10, verses 7 to 11 read, "Howbeit he meaneth not so, neither doth his heart think so, but it is in his heart to destroy and to cut off nations, not a few. For he saith, are not my princes all of them kings? Howbeit he meaneth not so, neither doth his heart think so, but it is in his heart to destroy and to cut off nations, not a few. For he saith, are not my princes all them kings? Is not Calno as Carchemish? Is not Hamath as Arpad? Is not Samaria as Damascus? And as my hand hath found the kingdoms of the idols, whose graven images did excel them of Jerusalem and of Samaria, shall I not, as I have done unto Samaria and her idols, so do to Jerusalem and her idols?" You know, the king of Assyria, He doesn't even begin to think that God is in control here or luring him on. Not at all. You know, God uses him as the rod of his anger towards the highly apostate nation Israel. The imagery of two tools of correction here are the rod and the staff. We're going to see in the next set of verses too. These were tools that the Israeli shepherds used. They had a staff which had that hook at the top where they would grab the sheep and move them around and pull them away from situations. And they had a rod, which is like a riding crop where they would hit them with. Now, both of those are viewed here as the correcting tools in the imagery anyway. But this king here, he believes that all his victories are because of his own military prowess and his own strength. He doesn't realize, because he's so prideful, he's so haughty, that God is using him to do this. And he's going to spare Jerusalem, but this guy doesn't know that at the time. Sennacherib here is boasting that no city can withstand his might, because his officers are as strong as kings and as if they have their own armies, and they're successful leaders. So he's saying, no one can stop us, nobody. And he asks this rhetorical question: is not Calno as Carchemish? Is not Hamath as Arpad? Is not Samaria as Damascus? These were cities near to the Euphrates River that originally belonged to Aram, which is modern-day Syria, and they were conquered by Assyria. So he's bragging, I took down all these cities, so hey, I'm not going to have any trouble taking down Samaria either. It's going to be just like when I conquered Damascus. And Samaria, as you will remember, was the capital city of the northern 10 tribes. It was located in the area of West Manasseh. So here he's saying that, hey, I'm going to be able to take down this too. Everything I do, I take down. I'm me. I can do everything. Now, I've put a map in your notes with red arrows pointing at these individual cities. It's a little hard to see the Tigris and the Euphrates River, but the Euphrates goes along with Erech and Babylon, and it goes up and to the north and to the west there, to the cities mentioned in our verses. And then we've got Damascus that he conquered, and he's saying, I'm going to come down here to Samaria, no big deal. Piece of cake, easy. This is easy to do. So he keeps boasting about this, and he's saying, all these countries relied on their false gods, and they didn't do them anything. He's even putting down the God of the universe by calling all gods false. There was a problem back then, because both the north and the south had gotten into idolatry, and they were worshiping idols, and they were selling, the Jews were selling idols to these other countries that Sennacherib had conquered here. So Sennacherib realizes that this is going on. I think it was pretty decent business for the Jews, because they'd gone apostate. So he's saying, hey, those false gods didn't do you any good. Go ahead and rely on your gods. You know, I'm going to conquer them too. It's no big deal. Well, what he didn't understand was that Hezekiah replaced Ahaz when Ahaz died. Hezekiah had a massive cleansing that took place, and he got rid of all the idols. So he was faithful to God, and when the Assyrians came down, they got 10 cities, walled cities, that they conquered in the south. They couldn't get to Jerusalem. They could not get to Jerusalem because Hezekiah loved God, and he got rid of all the idols. He got rid of them. Look what 2 Kings 18, verses 3 to 7 says about King Hezekiah. And he did that which was right in the eyes of Jehovah, according to all that David his father had done. He removed the high places and break the pillars, cut down the Asherah, and he break in pieces the brazen serpent that Moses had made. For unto those days the children of Israel did burn incense to it and called it Nehushtan. He trusted in Jehovah, the God of Israel, so that after him none like him among all the kings of Judah, nor among them that were before him, for he clave to Jehovah. He departed not from following him, but kept his commandments which Jehovah commanded Moses. And Jehovah was with him whithersoever he went forth. He prospered, and he rebelled against the king of Assyria and served him not. Now, the one thing I think that needs clarification here in this set of verses is the fact that when the children of Israel sinned in the desert, God instructed Moses, because they had been bitten by snakes as part of the judgment. God instructs Moses to make a bronze serpent, put it on a pole, hold it up, and the children of Israel that looked at that were healed, and those that didn't want anything to do with it perished from the poisonous snake bites. And then the Lord Jesus, he then refers to himself as being lifted up like the brazen serpent. I am going to be lifted up like Moses lifted up the brazen serpent in the wilderness. The problem here was, though, they turned this into an idol. They were worshiping that, burning incense and dancing around it like it had some magical power. You know, the Philistines stole the Ark of the Covenant in much the same way, thinking, wow, that's magic. We want that. We got it. Had no idea that God uses these things, but it's not magic in itself. That, you know, that's one of the reasons why nobody's found Noah's Ark, because they turned into an idol. They start worshiping it, and people would sell little pieces of the wood for $100 or something, you know. It's like buying holy oil or some junk, you know. And they start worshiping things instead of God. That's exactly what he doesn't want. That's why no one's found the Ark of the Covenant either. There's lots of speculation as to where it is, what happened to it. Nobody's found it. Nobody's likely to find it either, just because of these sorts of things. Now, the next section here talks about the prophesied punishment that the Assyrians are going to get. And it's only three verses, but it says, 12 to 14, wherefore it shall come to pass that when the Lord hath performed his whole work upon Mount Zion and on Jerusalem, I will punish the fruit of the stout heart of the king of Assyria and the glory of his high looks. For he hath said, by the strength of my hand I have done it, and by my wisdom, for I have understanding, and I have removed the bounds of the peoples and have robbed their treasuries. And like a valiant man, I have brought down them that sit on thrones. And my hand hath found as a nest the riches of the peoples. And as one gathereth eggs that are forsaken, I have gathered all the earth. And there was none that moved the wing or opened the mouth or chirped. So what he's saying here, he's going to bring a correction through the Assyrians on the northern tribes, and he's also going to allow them to go to the south and get these 10 cities. And the reason he's doing this is because of the sin. You know, the moral order of this universe has existed since it was created and has not changed. You know, through the Mosaic law, which was structured to get these people to pay attention to this law, to the moral order, and even now, we don't have the law, but we've got the moral order. It has not changed. They were engaging in extremely idolatrous, sinful practices. And it's interesting to see the countenance that gets described here of Sennacherib. The countenance of a prideful person gets looked at here and stated as the glory of his high looks. You know, eyes are the light, if you will, or the window into the heart. And if the eyes look up pridefully, they looking up. If the light in a prideful person, eyes are looking up. In a humble person, they look down. And I tell you to epitomize that. Have you ever seen any pictures of Mussolini? El Duce walked around like this all the time. You know, puffed up, prideful, and their eyes go up. The humble person is looking down somewhat. And that gets characterized in Scripture, too, because Proverbs 21:4 says, a high look and a proud heart, even the lamp of the wicked is sin. The lamp being the eye, the light into the mind, or the countenance, if you will, of the face, shows what the attitude of the individual is. Sennacherib, as his predecessor, Shalmaneser V, they're attributed the victory over Israel of his own military might and brilliant strategies. He refused to acknowledge a God. Now, when we get to a subsequent chapter here, we're going to go over in great detail what he did when he attacked Jerusalem. And how we know what he said, because he had it carved on what's called a stele. It's a big stone item here where he had somebody write out everything that he thought about that whole process. It's in the British Museum. We still got it. And the Oriental Institute, the University of Chicago, has a lot of artifacts from Assyria and Babylon too. If people are honest, they will realize that their talents, their capabilities, everything that they have came from others. It didn't come from us. You know, Romans 1, verses 19 to 21 shows that. This is what the Assyrian kings did, though. They took other nations and their wealth as easy as taking eggs from a nest that was unprotected by the mother bird. No one was able to oppose their military might for a while, for a season. And Sennacherib is saying that as easy as a man that finds a nest of birds and he takes their eggs, and it says here, as one gathereth eggs that are left by the bird, who is not presently sitting on them, there's nobody there to protect them. But if the bird is sitting on the eggs, she's going to try and fight somebody from taking them, or her young. She's going to flutter, strike with her bill, move around and make noises. And Sennacherib is saying, look, I gathered the whole earth here, kingdoms and inhabitants. There was nobody there to resist. None. Or that dared to do it. As follows, and there was none that moved the wing. Again, we're using this bird imagery here. As the bird will do to protect its eggs and its young. Or open the mouth or peeped. So, you know, the bird is going to cluck and move her wings and do everything she can to keep this from happening. And what he's saying is, Sennacherib is saying it, nobody cared. Nobody was there to resist or care. I just got my own things done by conquering these other nations. And we're going to close with these last last five verses, why God judged the Assyrians. Verses 15 to 19 read, shall the axe boast itself against him that heweth therewith? Shall the saw magnify itself against him that wieldeth it? As if a rod should wield them that lift it up, or as if a staff should lift up him that is not wood? Therefore, will the Lord Jehovah of hosts send among his fat ones leanness, and under his glory there shall be kindled a burning like a burning of fire, and the light of Israel will be for a light, and his Holy One for a flame, and it will burn and devour his thorns and his briars in one day. And he will consume the glory of his forest and his fruitful field, both soul and body. And it shall be as when a standard bearer falleth, and as the remnant of the trees of his forest shall be few, so that a child may write them. You know, the standard bearer, when the standard bearer falls, the army gets disillusioned, you know. That's the guy that's supposed to be showing us, leading things, and that's not good when the standard bearer falls. But the Lord has given Isaiah some really pointed questions to give to the world here that really characterize the essence of the problem of the pride of the Assyrians, because Assyria was a tool, and the first characterization, if you will, is illustrated as an axe that's in the hand of God. And what they're saying here is that Assyria was exalting herself over God, just like Satan did in his pride. Same thing. That's a denial of God's sovereignty in all situations. He is in control of all things. So, you know, will a saw that's held in the hands of the carpenter elevate itself and say, I can do this myself, I don't need the carpenter, or deny that there even is a carpenter? I mean, that's absurd. You know, I got a saw sitting in the garage. It's not getting up and telling me that it's going to do something today. Somebody has to do something with it. And that's the absurdity that God is trying to demonstrate here with these illustrations. And there's an action of the saw here that's being alluded to. And the staff is synonymous with the rod. Both are, you know, used by shepherds in shepherding sheep. But they're all references to implements of chastisement towards God's people that have sinned and gone way outside what he wanted them to do. You know, and again, the illustration here speaks for itself, but it's essentially saying, can the tool be alive and do all these things by itself? No, it has to be told to do something. And the Syrians were the tools that God was using. They were instruments. Even though they thought they were doing this on their own, they were employed. But mankind, in his schemes of pride and vanity, is boasting here about their prowess. They did it. But they're all under the control of the God of the universe. And again, I don't understand how this works, because I know God is sovereign, but he allows sin to continue. And all we know from the whole counsel of God is that it does have an end. It does have an end, and the great tribulation is what's going to pull out the lodged sin that is deep within the heart of human beings. And it takes that to pull sin out of this world. The Lord judged the king of Assyria and his empire, because the instrument is not above the one who uses it. They're not above God. And people get this attitude in pride in other situations too. We are in control. I am my own man, so to speak. You see it with people in positions of political power. They are in charge. Even this whole issue of climate change, people think we can control the climate. How absurd can we get to believe that? Or people think, I shouldn't have been born a woman, I should have been born a man, I'm going to make these changes. You can't make the changes. It's impossible. And it gets even more absurd when they let these men that get transsexualized to become women compete in the ladies' athletic events. They win everything because they're still men. I mean, that is the ultimate deception. Denying God. Denying God. Now, what we're going to see in the subsequent part of this book is that God was going to destroy the Assyrian army with disease and fire. And Isaiah 10, verses 33 to 34 here, a little later in this chapter, is going to give us a little more information about this. But the Assyrians are going to be consumed with a forest fire. The remaining trees, he's referring to the soldiers as that way, would be few, so few, even a child could count them. But in a subsequent chapter, we're going to see that when the Assyrians under Sennacherib tried to attack Hezekiah in Jerusalem, 185,000 Assyrian soldiers were killed by God in one night. And that's from Isaiah chapter 37. And I'll go into that in a lot more detail when we get there because it's a fascinating story. Then in 609 B.C., now that was 701 B.C., but in 609 B.C., the Assyrian Empire fell to the Babylonians. It was the Battle of Carchemish. And that was an enormously significant battle because it realigned all the countries in the Middle East. And the Egyptians were there, the Israelites were there, the Assyrians and the Babylonians. Babylonians came out on top, but it just seriously realigned everything. And right after Nebuchadnezzar won that battle, he just went straight down to Jerusalem to go get that. And he did. He corrected in the first invasion, in the first invasion of Jerusalem, he corrected, according to God's plan, the Jews that had turned apostate down there. Then he came back in 597 B.C., and then he came back again in 586, and that was the end of it. That was the end of it. So the fall of Assyria is a prototype of the fall of all who oppose God and have a personal prowess and a personal sovereignty, that we don't need God, we don't recognize God, we don't care about God, and especially what God's plans are for his covenant people, the nation Israel. You can look at the nation Israel today, and I'll tell you, 100 years ago, people laughed at the idea they would be back in the land, even though the scriptures, Ezekiel chapter 20, 22, and some other places said they were coming back. And people laughed about it and said, well, the scripture must be corrupt. It can't be true. Look at it. Nothing but desolation over there. They're back. They're back. And I'll tell you, what the Jews have done with the Jezreel Valley rivals the San Joaquin Valley in California. That is now the breadbasket of the Middle East. I mean, they're sending food down to Australia. There's so much produce coming out of the Jezreel Valley. They went in there, and a kibbutz is a communal living group. Nobody really owns anything, but they all own it all. And the kibbutzim, plural, were set up in the late 1800s in the Zionist movement, and they really got good here in the early part of the 20th century. And they cleared the swamps. A lot of them died of malaria doing it, but they cleared the swamps. They turned those swamps into an irrigation source, and they started watering that area, that valley, and it began to produce an enormous number of crops. Do you watch the nation Israel to see what God is doing with his covenant people? And it shows all the way through Scripture. He has not forgotten his people Israel. Shall we pray?